Do you have a child who struggles in school? Chances are you started noticing the challenges by or before 8 years old. But sometimes students get all the way to college or young adulthood before their uniqueness or struggles are really recognized or diagnosed. This seems to be particularly true with girls on the autism spectrum. Today, we're going to take a look at why there is a rise in young women being diagnosed with autism or ADHD. We'll talk about the impact of late or missed diagnoses and look at signs that your young adult may need some help. This is LD Expert Live. Welcome to LD Expert Live, your place for answers and solutions for learning differences, dyslexia, and attention challenges. I'm your host, Jill Stowell, founder of Stowell Learning Centers and author of At Wit's End, A Parent's Guide to Ending the Struggle, Tears, and Turmoil of Learning Disabilities. This book will help you understand why some bright children and teens struggle in school and what can be done to change that permanently. To get a free copy, go to parents@witsend.com. This is LD Expert Live. I'm your host, Jill Stowell. Our guest today is Dr. Monica Blyde. Dr. Blyde is a clinical psychologist, wife, mother of three, lupus warrior, and the founder of Faces of Health Wellness Center. Specializing in providing integrative care to adults with chronic medical illnesses, Dr. Blyde has expertise in the mind-body health connection, and she also provides assessments for ADHD and autism. She is the co-author of 12 journal articles, 4 book chapters, and over 60 conference presentations. In addition to her service as an adjunct professor at Pepperdine University, Dr. Blyde also serves the public through her work on the Medical Advisory Board for Lupus LA and the California Psychological Association. Welcome, Dr. Blyde.
Thank you so much for having me today, Jill. I'm so excited.
Well, I'm really excited to have you here. You have a wonderful, very diverse practice, and I would love to hear about what led you in these two directions of helping people live with chronic illness and your other focus of ADHD and autism?
Yes. Thank you for asking. So it comes from lived experience in wanting to pair that with my clinical training and areas of experience and expertise in ways that I can serve others, but serving in a way of like, I get it. So with a chronic illness, I have lived with lupus and fibromyalgia for the past 9 years and ADHD and autism. My husband lives with both. My stepson lives with both. Our 2-year-old is being evaluated right now. And so it's in our lives. And I understand from a personal side, like what those struggles look like with living with a neurodivergent brain style or living with chronic medical illnesses and the pain and the fatigue and the work-life balance, which is no such thing, but you know what that looks like. And so I try to pair that with, okay, here's what the research says and here are best practices to help people also navigate through those different differences.
Wow, that truly makes you an expert, you know, having both sides of that, both the education piece and the life experience. And I know before we really dive into this, you wanted to just kind of help people understand the language that you like to use.
Yeah. So there are a couple different ways to approach how we speak about autism and ADHD. There is person first language, which is a person living with autism. And then there's identity first language, which is an autistic woman, an autistic man. And so what has been the consensus over the past several years of people who are living with autism is like, hey, I want identity first language. So I'm an autistic man. I'm an autistic girl. Same thing with me living with chronic illness. I'm a lupus warrior. You know, it's part of my identity. It's not something that I'm ashamed of. And so I just want to let the audience be aware of that ahead of time, that I will be using a mix of two, but mostly identity first language. And also when I speak of girls or women, I'm referencing those who were assigned female at birth.
Thank you for that. That is really helpful. You know, over the past 18 months, there has been documentation that ADHD diagnoses have increased since the start of the pandemic. What have you seen in the assessment side of your practice in the last year and a half?
Yeah, so I've been doing assessments for the past decade, starting with my training at the UCLA Simmel Institute for neuroscience. And what I've seen in the past 2 years is so different. Like you said, it's like this explosion of people who are like, do I have ADHD? With adults and teenagers, those who were missed early on. ADHD and autism are neurodevelopmental disorders, meaning the developmental disorder, it's something that's present in early childhood. However, we're seeing people who with having a change in their structure. So going from in-person school and the ways that they had learned to cope and compensate with that structure to all of a sudden being getting all their lessons at home, and folks who were in a work environment that they were used to and had, you know, become well equipped to navigate, all of a sudden having to work from home. And when you think about at home, for a lot of people, this is our sanctuary. This is our place of peace. This is our place of fun. And so you have the kitchen really close. You have the, you know, the books and the toys and the games and things that you, you know, enjoy playing with or engaging with. And so there's a lot more distractions, one, but then there's a lot less structure and oftentimes also a lot less accountability versus sitting there in, you know, a cubicle or an office where the manager is also walking around and observing things, or sitting at a desk where your teacher is there to kind of hold you accountable, and you have the social modeling of everyone else also sitting in their desks. So wow. Much has changed.
It has. And that is so true. I think there was a lot of focus when kids were in online school about the stressors of being on the screen and the distractors of being on the screen. But really, there's a much bigger picture there in just how we relate to our environment, you know, our home environment versus a school environment. It's really interesting.
Yeah. And I want to bring it back to the structure part. When you are someone who it has been missed, so it's kind of flown under the radar with, you know, without a diagnosis of ADHD yet, it's because you've developed skills to be able to mask or to compensate the issues of inattention and procrastination and all that that you've been struggling with. But when your routines are interrupted, when your ways of being are now different, things really fall apart. Add to that stress, the stress of pandemic, the stress of knowing people who are getting sick, the stress of, you know, being anxious about yourself, you know, possibly, you know, getting sick and what that would mean to, you know, yourself and your family and your future. It becomes too much. It really overwhelms our nervous system.
Right, right. And of course, it's not just the pandemic that uncovers challenges. It's really any major change or stressor, going off to college or starting a new job, that might be the straw that breaks down all the carefully constructed compensations. So what are some things that parents might see or that a young adult might begin to recognize in themselves that would indicate that there could be some hidden challenges?
Yeah, when we think about ADHD, we think about symptoms of inattention and or symptoms of hyperactivity, because there are three different subtypes or presentations of ADHD. One is the inattentive presentation, and that looks like, you know, in school, this is the person who is the daydreamer. This is the person who is doodling, you know, but still able to capture everything that the teacher is saying, but still needs to otherwise be engaged. This is the person who, if we were in a room together and there was a bird that flew into my window, both of us would look, because both of us would have our attention taken away at that time. But the difference between myself, who is presumed neurotypical, and someone who has an ADHD brain is they would have a more difficult time controlling where their attention is, so bringing their attention back to me in the room. So when you think about, like, oh yeah, you know, I can pay attention, you know, for the young adult or for the parents. Yeah, my child can pay attention. In fact, they can play video games for four, five, 6 hours. You know, it's part of the hyper focus, the superpower of ADHD. But the issue is controlling where your attention goes. So also having a hard time with executive functioning type issues. So starting tasks, completing tasks, staying on task, those types of issues. The second presentation is hyperactivity. So in a young person, that is the person who, like, can't sit still or doesn't stay in their seat. As they become adolescents and young adults, they're better able to put a cap on that and manage that. But they may also like always be like fidgeting with their pens or with their fingers or tapping their legs or something like that, more of the motor activity, motor agitation. And the third subtype is the combined. You may actually have both. So when you think about having a hard time with things that your peers around you seem to not struggle with so much, as far as being able to, you know, have a schedule and maintain that schedule and be organized. And if you have a big project, being able to break it down into smaller components and work through those components versus kind of, you know, everything getting muddy and like, okay, well, where do I start? And then you get that kind of analysis paralysis where, like, I'm just not going to start at all because there's so much anxiety around this and so much, you know, disorganization as far as not even knowing how to approach it. When you start to notice those things, you might think about, like, could I have ADHD? Could my child have ADHD? Especially consider if that child is bright.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I see a lot of twice exceptional folks in my practice. Twice exceptional means that you're intellectually gifted plus you have ADHD or autism. Mm-hmm. These are the folks that really get missed. So if you are bright and you're getting good grades doesn't mean you don't have ADHD. It just means that.
Yeah, I was going to say, it just means that you figured out how to manage the system, you know?
Yes.
Because you're bright enough to compensate or.
Right. So these are the kids who still get good grades, but they're staying up until midnight to finish homework.
Yeah.
Because they didn't start until 11:30.
Yeah.
They can finish in 30 minutes.
That's right.
You know, but the procrastination is real. The issues with, right, you know, self-monitoring are an issue. The not being able to focus on boring things, but can hyper-focus on things that they're interested in. Those are all things that you start to see and wonder, like, is this something that, you know, my child could be struggling with or I myself is struggling with?
Right.
And the reason why I say the I myself, sorry, Jill, is like ADHD is as heritable as height, 70% heritability. And so oftentimes it's the child who gets diagnosed, they get picked up by, you know, someone at the school or a therapist or someone like, I wonder what's going on. And then as the child is going through the assessment process, the parent is like, well, shoot, I check off all those scores. I've been dealing with that all this time, you know, or, you know, I was just fine. I had one client who was an arborist and she was just fine when she was going out and, you know, looking at different trees and examining and collecting data for the different specimens. But as soon as she got a promotion and 70% of her job was in front of a computer, things fell apart.
Right.
Also very brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And so when someone like that comes to you and then you actually do give them a diagnosis, how does that feel to them at that point in their lives?
Oh,
typically.
It feels like if you've been in the desert, I'm just going to, you know, far-reaching analogies. That's another thing with ADHD. It's like, you know, I have these far-reaching analogies because you have this, you know, Ferrari brain, you know, things move super fast. But if you're, you know, if you've been in the desert and you're hot and you're thirsty and you haven't had anything to eat and everything's just so hard, and then you get a nice cold shower and a nice cold glass of water, it's refreshing. Because finally, for the first time, you feel understood. You realize that there is an explanation for your experiences and that you're not alone. I had one woman who came to me who was diagnosed with ADHD, but also was on the autism spectrum, which we didn't realize until later on within the clinical interview. But she said at the end of that evaluation, I feel so seen. For the first time in my life, I feel seen. And like, she was crying and I was crying. And it was just like, so rewarding for people to finally have an answer for this finally makes sense. I'm not lazy. I'm not dumb. It's not that I'm not trying, because it's not an issue of willpower. It's a neurobiological, a brain difference, a difference in our brain's structure, chemistry, and wiring that makes up ADHD. And when you can assign this biological explanation, it's so affirming and validating for people, and it really lifts that low self-esteem, a low self-worth that have been kind of pushed into their lives for so long, because there's been this gap between their ability level and how they actually show up in life, their performance level.
Right. I can totally see that. You know, in our work, especially with attention and executive function, awareness is the first step in making a change. And so being truly seen seems like it would be that same kind of catalyst for change. It kind of opens the doors to look behind all those compensations.
Yes. I tell all my clients, because I have a very small therapy practice as well, I say the gift of awareness is the opportunity to change.
Love that.
Affirming someone who gets this diagnosis that it's not changing yourself. Absolutely not. You know, because you are worthy and you have, you know, dignity and you are amazing and you have so many superpowers, you know, that come with autism, that come with ADHD. So it's not changing yourself, but it's changing the way you look at your struggles. It's not me. It's not a failure on my part. I am not damaged. I am not broken. This is a difference. It's a brain difference. And this is how I'll manage the challenges that come along with it. And this is how I'll hone in on the strengths that are also a part of it.
Right. So I want to focus on girls and young women here for a minute. Mm-hmm. Why are girls more likely to fly under the radar and get missed as having ADHD or autism?
Yes. Let's start with ADHD. So what we see most often in the literature is that there is a higher rate of the inattentive presentation of ADHD among girls. So they're not being caught by the teachers and being flagged because they're not jumping out of their seats and climbing up the walls and, you know, all those things as we typically see with those who were assigned male at birth. They are compliant. They are eager to please. And this actually goes with autism as well. There's so much social learning and social norms with girls of you need to be compliant. You need to, you know, impress others. You need to act a certain way and be, you know, certain ways. And we learn this from very early on. Mm-hmm. Versus there's the old adage that I think too many people still have in their back of their mind of, oh, boys will be boys. Mm-hmm. So not only is this little girl like just daydreaming and she's kind of quiet and she's still getting good grades and being missed, her struggles are being missed or overlooked. But there's also that social expectation that she would be quiet and compliant. And, you know, if something's wrong with her, maybe not to speak up about it. Mm-hmm. On the ADHD side, when we look at autism, what the last couple of decades of research have shown from scholars like Tony Atwood and a lot of people know Temple Grandin and others is that autism presents differently in girls than it does with boys. So in those who are assigned female at birth, there's actually a different neurostructural makeup of autism versus those who were assigned male at birth. So for, we look at males, what they've found so far in the research and looking at neuroscience is that a girl who has autism young looks more like a typically developing boy than she does look like an autistic boy or a typically developing girl. It's fascinating. So that's kind of like on an MRI brain level. But when we look at the characteristics and the differences, girls would typically have less of the repetitive behaviors. Girls, because of our social norms, they have, you know, they're more likely to fit in and not have the stereotypical boy autism behaviors. We also see that girls, they have a desire to fit in. Not only the desire to fit in, but also the social pressure of you need to fit in and conform. Versus boys, they can be nonconformist and they typically don't have that same social desire. So not as much anxiety about, you know, not fitting in or being singled out and those kinds of differences. I think that's why they get missed because it's like, oh, that girl has friends. Oh, that girl does, you know, play make-believe in the ADOS, one of the diagnostic assessment tools. One of the criteria is, you know, you ask like, does this person, does this child have imaginative play? Do they, you know, play with their Barbie dolls or tea sets and those kinds of things? And you'll see that in an autistic girl and an allistic or neurotypical girl. However, there's still a difference. The difference between the allistic girl, which is the non-autistic girl, is that she's making up full storylines and kind of having a true intuitive imagination around it versus the autistic girl is playing in a more mechanical manner. She may also still play, you know, tea party or have her doll set and those kinds of things. But it's like mom belongs here and dad belongs here. And then, you know, here's the, you know, the bride and the groom and those kinds of things. I wanted to mention before I forget that when it comes to late diagnosis of autism in women, what is shown is that these women have gotten the alphabet soup of diagnosis before they're finally diagnosed. There is a very high co-occurrence rate of eating disorders, specifically anorexia, OCD, and anxiety, and ADHD. So they're probably diagnosed with all four, some mood disorder, anxiety, depression, OCD, because of the ritualistic and the rigidity around the autism characteristics and, you know, needing to have things in a certain way. And then the eating disorder, if I haven't mentioned that already, I have a little executive functioning things myself because of the aspect of control, you know, that shows up. And it's not until you have someone who can look past the masking behaviors and ask the right questions that you find out, like, oh, yeah, this person is, you know, on the spectrum. This person is having this specific social communication and restricted behaviors, repetitive behaviors, restricted interest type issue, which is, you know, under the diagnostic criteria for autism. Another difference in girls, I love this. I could just like go on and on. Another difference in girls is that their restricted interests are typically more socially acceptable. So for in less stereotypical. So with boys, it'll be like mechanics and trains and, you know, those kinds of things, versus with girls, they may be really into video games or social media, but it's the intensity of their involvement and their knowledge around it that it's just like, maybe there's something else going on here.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, everything you're talking about, autistic girls are able to present more socially typical until you really, really observe that carefully and see how they're doing it. But on the surface, it seems like, oh, they're, you know, they're behaving the way we would pretty much expect. But obviously, if by the time they get diagnosed as a young adult, they've had three or four different diagnoses, then there's obviously been something that's been a little out of sync that, that you know, was hard to put your finger on. So as you get teens or young adults that are coming in, you know, with this kind of a history, what is your process for getting under all of that and discovering the real issue or diagnosis?
So I'd say asking questions. There are a number of like self-report inventories and forms that they can fill out, such as the social responsiveness scale and the social communication questionnaire. However, when you really get down to just asking questions, because one of the things that you typically pick up on is eye contact. And sometimes eye contact is too little or too much, where it's like you can tell that that person is cognizant and really trying to maintain eye contact because they know it's a thing to not have eye contact. So that could be if there's any kind of like awkwardness with that. But asking, you know, like, what are your friendships like? And how do you know if, you know, someone is angry at you? Or how do you know if, you know, and then input the emotional experience? Because what we see in a differential between ADHD and autism, because they both have executive functioning deficits, they both show up with problems with task initiation and organization and, you know, those kinds of things. A differential is the theory of mind, which is the ability to be able to recognize the emotions of others and know how to respond appropriately. So the girls who are coming in to, or women, you know, there are people as in their 50s who are first getting diagnosed. You know, the difference is that they may be able to mask and show up as, you know, social and communicative and having this back and forth conversation, which we call reciprocity. However, it's so much work. It's mm-hmm. exhausting for them. So ask them about like, well, you know, is it a lot of work, you know, to do this, you know, and those kinds of questions. That'll clue you in. I had one person who came in and we were actually doing ADHD testing, but I would have never, ever suspected that she was on the spectrum. One of the things, part of the day, what she had, you know, normal eye contact, normal, you know, reciprocity within the conversation. And even when I was like, oh, you know, I need to go like, you know, nurse my daughter during the break or whatever. She was just like, oh, how old is she? You know, so she was asking questions about me. And so, like I said, I would have never suspected. However, as we continued our clinical interview, she described how she, you know, wanted more support around dating because she couldn't really pick up on like flirting cues and that kind of thing. And she eventually disclosed that when she was in college, she would go to bars. And not for the typical reason that like college student goes to bars, but actually to study people, to study their facial expressions and what they were saying to be able to learn like, okay, well, someone does like this and then yells and that means they're angry, or someone does like, you know, this and then says, you know, whatever, and then that means that. And so she had learned these scripts. And she had developed scripts that had gotten her to where she was now, which was in her late 20s, working as an engineer, but also still very struggling in these other areas. And add to that the cultural differences for her, like in her family, you know, to pursue, you know, mental health support was absolutely like not acceptable. And there was a lot of stigma around it. She felt free. She felt understood to finally be like, oh, wait, other people don't go through that? Like other people don't struggle with, you know, the social communication and, you know, understanding, you know, these things and knowing how to respond. It was really fascinating.
It is. And it's so interesting to hear you say that. And I think with all of our well, with all of us, really, we all do this in whatever area our own struggle is. But mm-hmm. but when I think about our students with learning differences and how, you know, you can look at them and think they're lazy or they're unmotivated or they just need to try harder. But mm-hmm. really what's going on underneath that is they are really trying to figure out how they can manage this. And mm-hmm. and so, you know, what you were describing about her going to a bar and observing people and mm-hmm. trying then to create understanding and scripts for herself. I just think that's a huge thing that we need to internalize about our kids who struggle. Mm-hmm. They're really trying to figure it out.
Yes. Yes. So. And there's so much to be proud of
right.
them for. Like, wow. Like I'm always so impressed. Like, wow, you've gone this long with yeah. your, you know, neurodiverse brain style and like you've been able to manage. Like, wow, it's impressive.
It really is.
My husband described it this way. He said it's like the social communication aspect. It's like learning a second language.
Mm.
Every time you're trying to communicate in that second language, you have to like stop, take time to like translate in your mind first, you know, try to come up with the right word, try to communicate that, trying to understand what the other person is saying, retranslating in your mind. And sometimes you actually don't have the right word to say.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's a great way to think about it. Like mm-hmm. like a second language.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to ask you, you were talking about young adults who have recognized something and come to get mm-hmm. some evaluation and help. What advice do you have for parents who are starting to suspect that their young adult may have autism or ADHD, but the young adult isn't necessarily on board with getting an evaluation?
Maybe ask questions. Ask questions, remain curious, and start the conversation. Remain curious about why not get an evaluation. What's the worst thing that could happen? Because when you speak to the fear and you validate that, then that can, I think, help to build bridges versus like, no, you're going to get this done because I think this is going on for you. Because it could be like, to have a diagnosis could kind of shatter them. Like, oh no, there is really something wrong with them. Like, although they know there's something different, you know, but that internalized stigma may be there and may be very big and present. So just remaining curious and then also being open to the conversation, what you'll find more times than not is that the person wants to be seen. They want to understand how their brain works. And they want to also have the parents' validation, like, see all those times you put me in timeout, or, you know, when you forced me to go out with that person and play dates and stuff like that, like, you know, I was cringing, you know, and, you know, just to, again, approach it with like humility, approach it with kindness, and then ultimately respecting that person's decision. Because if your young adult child decides like, this is not something that I wanted to pursue at this time because the anxiety or the fear or internalized stigma are too big, then you've planted a seed. And what they'll most likely do is go on TikTok and watch some videos and, you know, try to get more ways to understand themselves and relatability. And then they'll be like, oh, okay, well, maybe I can, you know, get this diagnosis so that I finally can, you know, start to chart my path forward.
Well, that's great advice. Thank you for that. This is LD Expert Live. I'm Jill Stoll, founder of Stoll Learning Centers, and we're talking with clinical psychologist Dr. Monica Blyde about why autism or ADHD may get missed, especially in girls. Dr. Blyde, there is a rise in young women getting diagnosed with autism or ADHD, which means that they have been dealing with it without really being understood for a long time. What is the impact of living with hidden or undiagnosed challenges?
What the research shows is that there's a higher rate of suicide attempts and suicide completion. It really does negatively impact feelings of self-esteem and self-worth. Oftentimes it comes from externally. So parents or peers or teachers who are just like, well, why can't you just, and then fill in the blanks. And then it also becomes internalized. Why can't I just? Why is this so hard for me? It is so important to not struggle alone. And then also to know that you are not alone, to feel like you're in an island and nobody gets it. And, you know, it must just be me. I'm broken. There's something wrong with me. I'm reading this book right now. It's wonderful and I recommend it. It's called Sincerely Your Autistic Child. And it's edited, it's a compilation of different letters and stories from women, you know, assigned female at birth and non-binary individuals as well. Because there is a higher rate of non-binary individuals who are autistic, talking about like, I wish that I didn't feel like I was disappointing my parents by existing, that I'm not all that they hoped and dreamed of. Instead, I'm this extra work and I'm this extra challenge. And what I want to really, you know, share with parents and then with the individuals themselves is that you are worthy. And guess what, baby? There's a reason why autism is so prevalent in our human gene pool. I'm reading this other book called Survival of the Sickest. Highly recommend it. And it talks about why, you know, with evolutionary theory and biology, like the weakest kind of get like drowned out over time evolutionarily. So only the strongest survive is, you know, what was thought of before. But actually, if that's the case, why are we seeing so high of a prevalence of autism and ADHD and other medical illnesses? And what this PhD MD author is saying is like, there's actually a genetic advantage, a competitive advantage to having ADHD, to having autism, for example. We need people who can very narrowly focus on the details to be able to move our human race to the next place. We need the Elon Musks. We need the, you know, well, that's probably not a great example as far as personality things, but, you know, but we need the people who can, you know, spearhead technological advantage, right. Advances and, you know, things in our creative environment and so many other things. When it comes to the ADHD, there's actually been studies that have been done about when we go to early man and Neanderthals, there was a prominence of a specific gene, I don't know the name of the gene, that is associated with ADHD that survived. And what the theory is that ADHD survived because these were the people who were risk-taking. They were willing to go and try new lands and not just stay sedentary. They were willing to, adventure and explore. And that's what helped our human race to survive all these years. Like the reason why ADHD and autism exist so prominently in our society is because we humans need it. So not only are you worthy as a person with neurodiversity, but you're needed. You're needed.
Wow. Thank you for that. Yeah. Before we check back with our viewers, I think you have a poem that you wanted to share with our audience, and I'd love for you to do that.
Thank you. This is from the same book that I just referenced. And it's called Finding Me, The Journey to Acceptance. It's about a 3-minute poem by Morinike Anau. Little Morinike, so strange, overly anxious at the prospect of change, tiny hands flapping as she averts her gaze, twirling and spinning as if in a daze, hyperlexic days, echolalic nights, migraines and meltdowns caused by fluorescent lights or by a certain texture, smell, taste, or sound. They disturb her so much that she simply shuts down. The way that she thinks, it's so very literal. And the way she behaves is almost like a ritual. Things must be done in a particular way or else she is unable to cope with her day. Social cues elude her, inferences too. So very smart, yet she doesn't have a clue. Naive and trusting, she's a manipulator's prey. Easy to fool because she believes what you say. Languishing in a world whose rules are unspoken, she is perceived as defective and broken. One simple word could create a cataclysm of understanding, of acceptance. That word is autism. Mm-hmm. A 6-letter word that could have helped to explain that there was absolutely nothing wrong with her brain. But the words do not come. She remains unseen because she doesn't fit the profile. Know what I mean? She's not of the gender and not of the race that's associated with autism in that time and space. A Xennial growing up in between DSM 3 and 4, her autism presents in a way that they're not looking for. Plus, her IQ is high and she has the ability to speak. So she isn't perceived as disabled, just as a freak. She learns how to mimic, to mask, to hide. She suppresses herself at all times to survive. Her family lovingly tries to affirm her worth, asserts that she's also always been different since birth. You are unique, they tell her. Be proud. Never hide who you are. Live your life out loud. But how can she believe the kind words her family has spoken when the rest of the world has shown her she's hopelessly broken? So she somnambulates through years of her life in despair, choking beneath the mask of normalcy she must always wear. Over the years, her unshed tears well up inside, accompanied by a growing yearning for suicide. As a possible antidote to the pain that flows as readily as the blood in her veins, but a truth that's unknown does not cease to be. It watches quietly in the dark for a chance to break free. And through her despair, and though her despair seems incessantly vast, the day is coming that she shall be free at last. It happens by accident when she is all grown. She's now an adult with kids of her own. Her daughter is diagnosed with autism too, and her son too. Providers frequently remark, "The kids are so much like you." She builds up the courage to seek her own evaluation. When she receives the results, she's filled with elation. The paper states 299.0 F84.0 level 1. In other words, she is on the autism spectrum. Not a freak of nature, not a monstrosity, merely a person with unique neurology. If only she'd known about this way back then, she'd wonder how different her life might have been. But the past is gone, and nothing we can say can change what has happened. We must live for today. And though some parts of her life are still tough, she's doing her best, and that's more than enough. Little Morinaki grew up and survived. She is proof the life can be transformed when you're living your truth.
Hmm. Wow. That pretty much sums up the entire show. That was, yeah, that's incredible. And can you tell us the name of the book again? I want to have us put that in the chat.
Absolutely. That is Sincerely Your Autistic Child.
Great.
And it's written by folks who are part of the AWN, the Autism Women and Non-Binary Network.
Great. Thank you for that. That was beautiful. Dr. Blyde, what would you like parents to take away today?
I'd like to just remind parents that you are not alone in your experience. As Lauren shared, there is a support group, the Peace Support Group. There's the Mom Squad. There are other parents who have similar experiences. And so reach out for support. And not only that, reach out to others who, you know, are living with ADHD or are living with autism and are women so that your child can see that, like, hey, there's a role model. You know, there are, you know, lots of possibilities, infinite possibilities for my future, and that my mom accepts this person as a whole person and not as someone who is broken or, you know, strangely different or any of those things. And then also, you know, if you do realize that you are having the same struggles as your child, it's not too late. It's not too late to get an evaluation and better understand your experience and have an explanation for it. And then finally, I just want to say how proud I am of each of the individuals who are living with some sort of neurodiversity. You are important and needed, just like biodiversity. We need all the different organisms and species and all that to make this world what it is. We need the same with neurodiverse brain styles for our human race to continue and be what it is. And finally, I said the last thing was my finally, but finally one more. Even if you're not strong with executive functioning, even if you're not strong with social communication, you can help your child. You can get support for your child and have a different trajectory for them. You may have been late diagnosed, but your child can be early diagnosed and not go through the years of masking and compensating and struggling that you had to go through. You can chart a different course for them.
Thank you, Dr. Blyde. Wow, it has been a real pleasure to have you join us today. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Here is Dr. Blyde's contact information. Remember, she helps adults navigate life with chronic illness and does assessment for ADHD and autism spectrum. Her practice is in Claremont, California.